From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a historic city center where tourists and natives, both walking and bicycling, are experiencing the city. We could be talking about a number of places, Florence and Venice in Italy, Freiburg and Hamburg in Germany, or soon, Madrid in Spain. These are among what urbanists call reimagined cities, where the car is banned in certain places. Will we ever see the idea of car-free zones widely adopted in U.S. cities? Many urbanists hope so, and they are taking lessons from what they're seeing in international cities that prioritize walking and bicycling and deprivilege automobiles. So what can the U.S. learn from urban planning in other parts of the world? And how can we reimagine our cities to create more complete streets for everyone? We are thinking in a world fashion today because when we've talked about urbanism recently, some of our listeners will say, well, you talk about Rochester. How does it really compare what's happening in other places, especially outside this country? What is the context? Recently, we had a chance to talk to two people who are in studio with us, and they have a lot to share about that. I think such interesting ideas that come from around the world, starting with Howard Decker, a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester, who was just in India for how long in India?
Just over a month.
A month in India, seven different cities, comprising a population combined of 70 million people.
Correct.
So a little bit more dense than Rochester.
Just a little bit, about six times more dense.
Nice having you back here.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Evan.
Jackie Marchand is president of Woman Tours, Inc. And I think for a sense of where Jackie has been and her company's been, why don't you tell us what Woman Tours is, Jackie?
Well, we run bicycle tours for women all over the country. I'm sorry, all over the world. About a third of our trips are abroad. In Europe, India, Asia.
And you've been involved directly with the company for, 15 years now?
Yes.
And so you aren't on every tour, but you go on quite a lot of them. How many different countries would you say you've visited just as part of the Woman Tours job?
Oh, how many different countries? Probably around 30 so far.
About 30 so far. And there are automobiles that Woman Tours rides with as well, we should say. But for the most part, you try to be on a bicycle as much as you can.
Yes, that's the point.
And Jackie, in some of the notes before the program began, had some interesting things to say about the difference between being on a bicycle or on foot and in a car. Because when we travel, let's say we fly to Italy, we might rent a car, hop in a car, and start driving through the countryside. What do you think the difference is in experiencing a place when you're inside a car versus on foot or on a bicycle?
Oh, it's completely different. For example, we were in Cuba, and we see all the buses go by full of the tourists, and we were on bicycles, and we passed a whole bunch of people harvesting some kind of vegetable. I don't remember what it is now. Well, we got off our bikes. We started talking to them. They started showing us the vegetables, how they did it. And meanwhile, everybody on the bus had gone long past it. They didn't get to interact with anybody.
Zipped right by, which would happen if you had rented a car for yourself as well. So you have the option to stop and to talk and to absorb more.
Yes.
And maybe to taste at the roadside markets and things like that.
And really interact with people. On the bus tours, you know, you tend to get off at a site, a monument, and you go in, get a little tour, and then you're back on the bus.
Now, Howard, for the listeners who are used to hearing you rail against the automobile, you know, that's the cartoonish character I've created in you, but and which you sort of enjoy, I think.
I do.
Okay. But when you travel to cities in India, for example, seven cities, 70 million people, how do you even deal with a population density like that with the automobile? I mean, you almost don't have an option for an automobile once you get so dense, do you?
No. Well, actually, the mobility issue in the big Indian cities is beyond crisis. The traffic there moves at an average of about 5 or 6 miles an hour. And the projection is that in a few years' time, the traffic will not move at all. So clearly, big Indian cities have got to find some other way to promote the notion of mobility, some other notion than the car. And they're working on it, but it's a very difficult problem. So the best way to see an Indian city is with your feet or, as Jackie has observed, on a bike. Because then you can actually move around and see things. In Delhi, for example, traffic is breathtaking. Delhi is a city of over 20 million people, and they just opened the final segment of their subway system, a subway system that probably most people who visit Delhi would never see, but a subway system that carries 1 billion riders a year, and it's not enough. So mobility issues are very big challenges in lots of places, but certainly in big Indian cities.
And I think there are lessons. We're going to talk about India. We're going to talk about Christchurch. We're going to talk about places that have had to, for different reasons, decide how they want to go forward, whether it's growing populations and density, whether it's natural disaster. We'll talk about those decisions. How do you want
to? But one thing I think that I want to kind of continue with my cartoonish character here, Evan.
Okay, of course.
And I want to just let your listeners know that I was curious after I realized how slowly the traffic was moving in the big cities of India. I was curious to compare it with Rochester. And it turns out that of the 50 cities that you might put on a chart to compare them with respect to average traffic speed, the third fastest traffic speed in the United States is Rochester. And the city in the United States with the third lowest level of congestion is Rochester. So Rochester is a completely car-dominated city where people find it very convenient to drive very, very quickly. And it's a completely distinctly different than being on a bike somewhere in Cuba or wherever you might be, or walking in a big city like Delhi, for example.
Well, and let's be blunt, and listeners, as we go throughout the hour, anything you want to weigh in on as we talk about our own population density, designing and redesigning cities, how it compares to cities around the world. If you've traveled, 844-295-TALK, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. You know, Howard, when it comes to what Rochester is trying to do, every city in the country is trying to stem the loss of population. And in Rochester, it's an issue for a number of reasons, jobs, climate, et cetera. But if cities are to be successful, they're going to have to deal with the redensification may or may not be a word, but we know what we're talking about of population. And if that's the case, you know, it's not going to be India. It's not going to be the cities that you were in India. But it's still going to be more of a challenge. In other words, it's not going to be 18 minutes or less everywhere you go in a car, the way we seem to think it will be now in perpetuity, I think.
I think that's right. And I think that in cities all over the world, whether it's, and they're certainly thinking about this seriously in India, likewise, they're thinking very seriously about this in China, for example. They're thinking about how to create nodes, places where you can walk for half an hour, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and find everything you need within that radius or so. And that's a way of making cities more dense because you can walk, of course. That means you can live more closely. But it also means that we're mixing up everything. We're mixing up what's available to us. We're mixing up who we live with and who we are and so on. And I think that's a model that's probably more more sanguine for our future than, oh, let's drive around, which doesn't seem to be working here so well, but certainly isn't working at all in many other places in the world.
Sure. And Jackie, you're someone who, even though right now Rochester, as Howard said, is third on the list of fastest traffic, you could drive everywhere. You're someone who talks the talk and you bike the bike. I was going to say walk the walk. You walk the walk and you bike the bike.
I do. I try to bike or walk everywhere I go. I really think twice before I take my car. It's not because it's something I think I should do or wanted or need to do. I really enjoy it. And I think if more people tried it, it would put them in a better mood. I get to a better place when I'm at the office and I, you know, think of what I need to do the next day on my way home. You know, I want to talk a second about Paris. You know, you're talking about big cities, and Paris is the number one tourist destination in the world. So not only do a lot of people live there, but a lot of people travel there all the time. And yet it is the easiest place to get around. And they were one of the first with a bike share program. And it was one of the first places that I used a bike share program, actually. And we have that here now in Rochester. But and what they did really well there is they made it easy for people like me who don't really know their way around the city to get around. There are signs everywhere. There's directions. There's little bike signs that tell you how to get to Notre Dame or the Louvre. There's a whole infrastructure just set up for people who are visiting to get around.
And what's interesting is that the mayor of Paris and the mayor of Madrid, where they're going to be soon doing a very similar thing that they're doing in Paris, are both women. These are women-led cities. And finally, these mayors are under a lot of criticism, But what they're trying to do is to create cities where it's all about something other than the car. And both Madrid and Paris are rooting the car out of the center city in favor of bikes, walkers, the metro, all of the other ways of enjoying urban mobility instead of spending your time in a car.
Yeah, I was just in Madrid with the WXXI Travel Club in March, and this was a common topic of conversation throughout those 3 days in Madrid. Do you think, do both of you think, is there anything to that when women are in charge of cities? Is there, from what you've experienced, a difference in planning and urban design compared to men? Or is it not a large enough sample size to draw a conclusion?
Well, I would like to believe so because I'm a woman, but I don't really know.
and I would like to say that I believe it is true, and I wish it were even more true every day, because the cities where you visit that have women in charge tend to be cities where there's a better discussion about urban issues and less of a desire to protect the things that some of us have historically thought are important, but we are learning are not very important at all.
Sure. And Jackie, what are you hearing when you travel to other countries, when you have conversations about the differences in transportation? I mean, Americans generally, and I'm going to overgeneralize now, but a lot of Americans think, well, bicycling is nice. I could never do it year-round. A lot of people will say that, even though you prove the opposite.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of people will say, I could never do it year-round. I couldn't do it with the bulk of my travel for work or for home needs. In other countries, certainly they find other modes of transportation. What are the conversations like when they think about how Americans travel?
Well, I have to say, when I go abroad and ask and meet people and they say, oh, I've been to the United States, and I'll ask them, well, what is your, you know, what do you think of? What do you like about the United States? And 9 times out of 10, they say our roads. We have an amazing road system. We have an amazing interstate system, unlike anywhere else in the world. We were first. And so it's something, you know, we can be proud of, but it does have its downside. And that is that it does take people away from these urban centers where people live, where people want to move around. I'm sorry, Evan, I think that was a little off your topic.
No. I find that very interesting because I think Howard cringed a little at the interstate. She's right, but you wish you were wrong, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we have a highway infrastructure system that's so sophisticated that it makes it very hard for us to get people to think about what it really costs us and what damage it's really doing to our metropolitan areas and to our urban life. We need to be critical about the value of that. But it's interesting that even in northern cities in northern Europe, for example, when in the winter, when it gets cold or when it snows, they plow for the bikes. So all you have to do, if bicycling is like important to you, all you have to do is make it a priority. If you were to experience bicycling in Rochester in the middle of winter, it's a little bit more difficult because nobody does anything in preparation for the bicyclists, but in Europe they do, and it's much easier. So if we were to prioritize bicycling to a greater extent than we do and make that more an essential part of our mobility, then it would work fine in the winter or fall or spring as well as the summer.
The year-round bicyclist in the room, Jackie, you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I do tend to walk more in the wintertime. You know, if we haven't cleared the roads, then I can't bike on them.
Yeah.
It makes it really hard.
Yeah.
You know, and there are so many more reasons to promote biking and walking that don't have anything to do with urbanism. I mean, don't have anything to do with, I guess, way of life. But there's health issues. There's motor vehicle accidents that are skyrocketed. And there's all these, you know, I was given a quote the other day that half of children 16 or under are going to develop diabetes before they're an adult. That's just frightening. And we need to get people outside. And we need to develop systems and of getting moving people around. It's just, I don't go out and decide, okay, I'm going to go to a health club and work out today. I just take a bike ride. I just go to work. And I've done my health activity for the day.
Well, let's do this here. Let's start, grab a couple of phone calls. And I will tell our guests as we go to your phone calls, Howard Decker's writings on the subject of having traveled recently to India and the 7 cities he traveled to and the lessons learned. We're going to cover more of that as we go throughout the hour, but if you want to absorb all of that, set it aside, we'll link to it on our Twitter platforms and we'll throw a post to it as we throw this conversation up on the podcast page at wxxinews.org/connections, where all of the full hours of conversation go, so you can check out what prompted this conversation about international urbanism and the lessons we might be able to bring home. I'm I'm going to grab Bob and Shalott first on the phone. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, Evan, how you doing,
good,
man? Well, first of all, as far as diabetes, talk to the FDA about that. But anyhow, what I'm just bringing up devil's advocate here. If you understood or have read or studied a UN Agenda 2030, where their plan is within some years to really take these cities and put a new twist on the concentration camp, and part of it is to demobilize the potential of the citizen base. So when you're walking and taking bikes, you're really not going anywhere. You're kind of contained. If you want to take mass transit, well, the camera's on you. Do you have your papers? Who's your ID? Who are you? You're on a city transport, so who are you? I'm just saying that if you take away the mobility of a society, they are easily more herded into the cattle pen. So on the surface of this being healthy and good for the environment and no car accidents, that's great on the surface. But underneath that surface lurks the possibility that we're not going to be going anywhere. That's just the point. Thanks for listening and talk amongst yourselves. Thank you.
All right, Bob, thank you. Howard Decker.
Well, unlike the caller, I'm not terribly anxious about these matters. And unlike the caller, I'm not concerned that suddenly we're going to be herded into some series of enclosures because we no longer favor our cars the way we should. I respect the fact that he feels that way, but I look to a future where our mobility is more broadly understood than it is today.
Okay. That was a mild response, I think.
I could offer a more strident response, but I'm trying to be as measured as I can under the circumstances.
Okay. Jackie?
I think that, speaking to Howard's point that in India they're moving at 5 miles an hour or something like that in some of these cities, I think getting on a bike you can move at 15, 20 miles an hour pretty easily.
Yeah, and I think it suggests that the kind of zero movement in automobiles that your caller has identified as being scary is already occurring in many places, and so we really have to broaden our thinking, I think, and imagine other ways of moving around places.
And I would say to Bob's comment on the idea that there's a camera on you on a mass transit, on a subway, I mean, I understand anyone who doesn't like that or is uncomfortable with that. That is also the case in just about everywhere you go in public spaces now. There's a camera just about everywhere.
The city with the most surveillance cameras of any city in the world is London. Hmm. And so it's already happening. It's almost impossible for anyone in London to move through the city without being on many cameras in the course of a day.
So I would just say to Bob, I mean, I think that's probably,
it's already here.
It's probably a separate conversation. It's not just a transit conversation. Yeah. If you don't like cameras on you at all times, it's a separate conversation on whether we as a society should accept that.
You need invisible paint.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, it's true. Noel in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Noel.
Hey there. I promise not to be paranoid. I grew up in L.A. I've been living in upstate New York since 75. I don't miss it in the least. As a child, we thought nothing of riding our bicycles from West L.A. to Malibu, West L.A. to Pacific Palisades. Part of being a growing up child is memorizing the map so you know how to get back and forth on your bike. I came to Rochester, New York in 2007 and rode my bicycle from World Gym on East Avenue back to East Rochester many times. I got to use the bus. I would say if people get really excited about the bicycle thing, they're going to have to retrofit the buses because the buses only carry two bicycles, which is unfortunate because if three of us show up, or even if you're waiting for the bus and here it comes and it's already got two bicycles on it, you're out of luck because I don't think they're going to let you carry the bicycle onto the bus. I love Rochester and it's a great city. Other than peak traffic hour on 490, I don't usually run into any traffic issues. So,
okay.
Noel, I promised I wouldn't be paranoid this time.
Noel, thank you for the phone call. Howard, you got your hand up. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking that I think that what we're talking about this afternoon is more than just moving around a city. it's more than mobility. It's the reason why we want to be mobile. And I think your caller has really helped us to understand through his memories, helped us to understand why we want cities to be more compact, why we want it to be easier to move around, because it enhances the way in which we experience our lives in urban settings, and it enhances the way in which we live our lives on a daily basis. So it's not just about our long-standing opposition to automobile domination in our metropolitan areas, but it's an awareness that, as Jackie said at the outset, it's better to experience places on a bike or by foot, and it leads to a better experience and to a better life than the alternative.
Okay. Jackie, you want to add to that?
I want to get back to the international aspect of this and what Howard and I have seen in other cities, and that there's a belief that accidents can be mitigated, that it's not just the responsibility of the driver anymore, and it's really the responsibility of the whole community and planners. There are so many, I just think of all the underpasses and all the cities abroad, that every time there's a big intersection, it just keeps all of the pedestrians away from all of the cars. So when there are these urban centers where people feel comfortable walking or biking around, they make it safe for them. And I think that's something we have to be more and more aware of here in the United States.
There's a movement, it's called the Shared Space Movement. And the idea behind that movement speaks exactly to what Jackie's talking about. And it says that on a street, there's no curbs, there's no signs, there's no stoplights, there's no nothing. Everybody is everywhere, and the street belongs to pedestrians, bikers, cars, trucks. They all move together on the street, but they have to do so responsibly in a shared way. And when they first started experimenting with this notion of shared space, anticipating that the accident rates would rise, they were shocked to discover that, in fact, they went down. And now there's plenty of experiences which show us that if you take away the constrictions such that all people can use the space, like we call it complete streets here in the state of New York, in a complete streets fashion, that in fact the rate of collision, if you will, between different modes, people, so on, actually goes down. So Jackie's exactly correct. I mean, this is clearly what we need to do, is to think about our streets as belonging to a bike, a skateboard, a walker. All modes equally share the right to have access to the street.
You're hearing Howard Decker, a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester, who recently spent about a month in India and visited seven cities with a total population of 70 million. A lot of thoughts about what their transportation issues are and how they might apply here in different ways with different lessons. And we are going to get back to that in our second half hour. We'll come back to Howard and talk about what really stands out most transportation-wise, the challenges and how they are being addressed in different cities. Jackie Marchand is president of Woman Tours, Inc., and that is it's a bicycle company. It's a company that offers bicycle tours for women only here and around the world, and Jackie is sharing her experiences here and around the world as well as we talk about transportation issues. Before we jump back there, let me grab one more phone call in our first half hour, and it's Jim in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Jim.
Howdy. First off, I'd like to say that I love this discussion.
Thank you.
I am someone who has owned and still owns several cars, always have, and love old cars. But that being said, I wholeheartedly support more of an infrastructure for biking. I love to bike. I have several bikes. One of my favorite things in the world is just hop on my mountain bike and bike around here. I think in this area, we are extremely fortunate to have the kind of geography that provides a balance for both cars and bikes. And I would be ecstatic if I saw green bike lanes in every suburb and every part of the city. And I just love the discussion. I love the fact that this is being talked about. I don't agree with the walking in the street thing. I'm a big advocate of sidewalks and designated areas for bikes, and I love the feel of that and the balance of it. I don't like the idea of just people walking all over the street. But that being said, I love the discussion, I love the points being made.
Yeah.
And I think it could lead to us being one of the healthiest cities in the country.
Inclusive of both infrastructures, as you kind of say, Jim.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are very fortunate in having a balance and a low population density that allows us to have such a freedom of movement. It's overlooked, and I'm glad it's being brought up.
Sure. Jim, thank you. I would say before I kick it to both of our guests to ask them what they think a balanced infrastructure really functionally looks like here, I will just say you're right, Jim. The population density is much smaller here in Rochester compared to what was it, 30,000 population density in India?
30,000 per square mile. It's about six times what Rochester is.
Okay. So no question, Jim, you're right. We have more of an opportunity to use the automobile if we like. I would also again just point out that the goals of all the political leaders here and the economic leaders, etc., is to have that population density increase, to have more people move here to all parts of our area, in the rural areas, suburban areas, and the cities. And if that happens, there's going to be more of a need to have these conversations as opposed to more of a, well, for some people, a hobby. It's not a hobby to Howard. This is a passion. But let's ask both of you, what does balanced infrastructure look like in Rochester functionally? Jackie?
You know, it's an integrated system. It's like the earlier caller said, it's a bus system that can handle bicycles. It's a bike path that goes from the airport. It's a shuttle that goes in between the airport and the train station. It's that we think about how people move and how they can get from one place to another. Sure, not everybody wants to bike when it's 20 degrees outside in January, but we need to have ways to move everybody that doesn't include cars all the time.
Howard.
I think that Jackie's pointed to the real crux of this matter, which is Rochester needs to have as many transit tools in its toolbox as possible. Right now we have one, and it doesn't work very well. It's called the bus. But we're improving the bikeways throughout the city. We're rethinking our transit system, the bus system. We're trying to think about how to provide a greater number of transit tools in our transit toolbox. That's certainly where we need to go. And let's remember what the goal here is. We live in a city that has a future that's staring at us and challenging us to make the city better, but and better prepared for the environmental, health, and economic challenges which lie ahead of us. And mobility is one way of starting to think about how to make cities fit for a future for all of us and for our children and for our children's children. So mobility is a key issue, but it's not the only issue that we face. If we have more transit tools in our toolbox, it'll be easier for us to move around, and we'll be healthier, and we'll have less pollution. Try waking up in the morning early, say 5:30 or 6 in the morning in Delhi, and take a look at the pollution there. It's really hard to see about more than about 100 feet. The pollution is so bad. And most of it is generated by automobiles. So these are real issues that we have to face in our urban centers and begin to try and figure out how to solve.
As we go to our only break of the hour, I will just tell you that one of the themes that Howard put in my brain is, if you could have traveled to every American city, small and large, and you could have traveled to every European city, small and large, and you can envision and have a pretty good memory of all of them, and then you were randomly dropped into an American city and then randomly dropped into a European city, you're much more likely to know which European city you're in because there's more character. It is less of a homogeneity. Here in this country, perhaps because of the grid addiction to cars and the commercialism of fast food, it is hard to tell where you are in this country more and more. And that's kind of by design. We have done that on purpose. What does that mean for our communities, for distinct communities, for the character that we want to preserve everywhere we go? I thought it was just a fascinating question, one among many ideas that Howard has brought up. So again, we'll post some of his writings on his travels if you want to check them out on our various platforms. Let's get that break now, and we'll come right back to more of your phone calls and conversation on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, there are four semifinalists ready to play in the World Cup this week: France, Belgium, England, Croatia. We decided to invite panelists from all four nations to join us to discuss why the World Cup means so much. The culture, the customs, the songs. We hope to have a little fun and make it educational as well. Next hour as we talk World Cup on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me grab a phone call from Dave in Rochester, who is calling with some experience and data related to India. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, I was in the late 60s. I lived in India with the Peace Corps, and I have wide experience in New Delhi and also Calcutta, used to be Calcutta. And it should be mentioned that at least at that time, there were, in Indian cities, one could see elephant, camel, herds of cattle all over the place, and the ubiquitous cycle rickshaw, in addition to buses, cars, trolleys. And so there was a huge heterogeneity of ways to get around. As the middle class began to increase, they all wanted automobiles. So India began producing its infamous clunky-looking ambassador. And now, of course, you see all kinds of vehicles. And your speaker, who had been in India more recently, may attest to maybe the fact that rickshaws are vanished. But in Calcutta, in the late 60s, I saw also the infamous ancient rickshaw powered by human labor. Usually the untouchables, Dalits, would pull a couple of people seated behind them in these covered black rickshaws. And when the government decided it looked fairly primitive in the eyes of tourist cameras, they attempted to abolish that. As the cycle rickshaw also began to cause embarrassment in places like Singapore and Kuala Lumpur, very congested cities. So it was a shame because it put a lot of these street people out of work, and I have no idea what they're doing now. Hmm. But the rise in the middle class certainly precipitated, also in our country, from the horse and buggy to, you know, the Model T to these cars, and then what's his name, the famous urban planner, is responsible for largely for our highway system, Robert Moses and others. So it's a mixed bag. But I'm wondering, I've been in New Orleans as well, and you can take horse-drawn carriages as well as the famous St. Charles Street streetcars from point A to point B, and they're lovely. And of course, there is traffic on main avenues in New Orleans, but I just wanted to sort of add a enhancement to the descriptions of Indian cities.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Yeah, I appreciate the phone call. Thank you, Dave. Howard?
Well, the bike rickshaw is still there.
Okay.
It's used now in places like Delhi, for example, mostly by tourists, as a way of giving the tourist an authentic Indian experience.
Which turns out to be not all that authentic.
Right. It's been around for a long time.
So what is authentic? What really stands out from your travels there, then, when it comes to the challenges of transportation and the population density?
The biggest challenge is the mobility question. And the solution has nothing to do with cars. They have to totally rethink urban mobility. In India, many people have cars, but many people have motorbikes, and there's a lot of other motorized stuff moving people around. And the road infrastructure is very poor. So, of course, the roads fill very quickly and increasingly because there's more and more cars. And the solution is not to build more roads, because we know what happens when you build more roads, you have more traffic. And the solution is not to make it easier for cars, either to park them or to move them or to run them. Or the solution is to get rid of all that stuff. They tried in Bangalore a system where they would reduce congestion in the center of the city with odd license plates and even license plates being able to move into the city on alternate days. So if it was Monday and you had an odd license plate, you could go downtown and so on. And they tried it and they had riots. So they had to rescind it. And they waited 2 years, but the traffic is so bad in Bangalore that the city mothers and fathers felt that they needed to try it again. So they tried it again, and there were riots again, and they stopped doing it again. But clearly, in order for these cities to, and there are plenty of Indian urbanists who will tell you that Bangalore is a dead city because it's so problematic with respect to mobility. But clearly the solution is to find a way of moving that has nothing to do with automobiles. And what that does is that it gives us back a much more fine-grained city. It gives us back the kind of city that Jackie was talking about, where you can bike or walk and see things and experience things at a more, at a much closer, at a much smaller scale level. And that notion of, if you will, granular urbanism is, I think, where we have to, certainly where we have to head. And that means that in a city like Bangalore or Delhi, or we need to connect centers or nodes or neighborhoods, quarters or areas of the city, kind of find ways to connect them, but to enhance each of those kinds of nodes so that they work better for everybody who lives there.
In a moment, I want to ask both of you about Christchurch, New Zealand, which for interesting reasons, offers some insight on choices we can make. But that was a choice forced by a crisis. I want to ask both of you, in your travels abroad, if Americans who are pessimistic or cynical about the idea of going away from the car at a large scale are being too cynical. And I think of Howard, as we mentioned, Madrid is about to, this coming November, they're going to ban non-resident cars from the central city in Madrid. City Lab wrote a piece on that. Florence, Italy has closed off its historic center, about 40 blocks, to all but pedestrians, taxis, and buses for years. That's true in a lot of different Tuscan towns, sometimes for reasons of need, sometimes for reasons of choice. Venice is car-free. Freiburg, Germany, banned cars in its historic center in 1973 and built extensive bike and trolley infrastructure. So, I mean, to Jackie, it's not just a case where some European cities just were never designed for the car and really never adapted the car. Some tried to move toward the car and then moved back in the same way that we kind of talk about doing here, and have proven that it can be done, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you experience in Europe, do you feel that sense of optimism that this can happen? That this isn't just a case of, well, they never brought cars here, so it's easier for them.
No, absolutely. I think they're following what their inhabitants want also. You know, I don't want to drive in London. I don't want to drive in New York City. I mean, they're making it hard. Nobody wants to drive in these major cities anymore, so it's easy to ban non-resident cars now. It's kind of like which came first, the chicken or the egg sometimes. It's maybe you can speak better to it, Howard.
Well, I think that what I would do would be we need a junket. We need to create a junket, and we need to take Rochesterians to a couple of places in the world where they wouldn't feel threatened.
Okay.
They wouldn't feel like they were somewhere that was so weird that they couldn't understand it, or that people looked weird or were wearing weird clothes or eating weird food. One of the first places that I would take everybody is Melbourne in Australia. Australia, Melbourne, probably the best transit system on earth. And it's not just a subway, but it's trains, buses, streetcars, some bike paths. It's a whole host of tools, if you will, and the city works great. And I don't think anybody in Melbourne, I mean, the people that we know, our friends in Melbourne, they have a car, and people drive cars in Melbourne. So your earlier caller who was worried about, you know, what might happen if all the, well, you know, people in Melbourne, they think cars are fine, but they find it easier to move around their city, and they find it easier to enjoy each other in their city by other modes. So we could take people around to various places and show them cities that really work great, cities that are not so wildly foreign to a Rochesterian that they would feel threatened by it. Paris is another perfectly good example of a city that it works great. So, yeah, there are many cities that work great, and there are plenty of them that are, in fact, very foreign. But it's very easy to take people around and show them what it means when it works well.
Well, you know, I'm just going to challenge you on one point. As you said, if you add more car lanes, what happens, Howard?
More traffic.
Yeah, but if you added 100 lanes on both sides, then maybe you would have
more traffic. Look,
even 100, Evan, 1,000 lanes, Howard.
When you go to Beijing, you cross the 10th.
I want 7 miles of car lanes on both sides for every
go
street.
To Beijing. You got it. Right? In Beijing, the 10th ring road. The 10th ring road, not the inner loop, the 10th ring road has 20 lanes.
Wow.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, we could just keep building more and more lanes, and we'll have, of course, as a direct result, more and more traffic. So that clearly doesn't work.
But you also get more dead zones. You get an inner loop like we have in Rochester with nobody lives around it anymore. If you've got, you know, 100 miles of lanes of cars, then you've got nobody living there anymore. You've got no shops. You've got no reason to be there. It's just a place to travel from and to, you know, from one place to get to another place.
And so we have...
And that's why we want to get rid of the car. It's exactly what Jackie is saying, because it's better without it.
Now, so you have choices. And as we've been pointing out, as we look around the world, the Madrids of the world are making these choices. Howard is back from India, where they've had a lot of choices to make. Christchurch, New Zealand is a city that had to rebuild infrastructure and could have gone in a couple of different directions. I'll start with you, Howard. What's the lesson from Christchurch?
Well, Christchurch had a horrible tragedy. It had a very violent earthquake, and much of the city was destroyed and many lives were lost. People in Christchurch were faced with a challenge. We need to rebuild our city. We have at least two choices. We can rebuild our city with an eye towards creating a resilient, sustainable, wonderful place that's not like anything we've ever seen before, but fits us best for our future. Or we can choose to build Christchurch back just the way it was as fast as we can. And those seem like two very understandable choices. Unfortunately, Christchurchians chose the second option, and they have built back Christchurch. It's almost done now. Not quite. There's still plenty of things yet to do there, but much of it is complete now. And it's filled with sprawl. There's cars everywhere, stripped shopping malls, and all the kind of junk which we normally associate with the worst of city making that you can imagine. So they had a chance, but it didn't quite work out. And it's really a shame because Christchurch could have been, it's a really interesting place, and it could have been sensational.
Jackie, if you were on a planning board in Christchurch, what would you have told them?
Well, I think that was part of the problem. I mean, I'm not intimately involved. I don't know what happened, but I was there in between Howard's first visit and his most recent visit, and I saw it in the process, and I thought, where is the plan? Mm. Where is the grand plan here? You could just see there were bits and pieces of work being redone, of buildings being rehabbed, some being just gated around with, you know, do not enter signs, and others being run up with cardboard and sustainable products that were going to fall apart within a year. And it's just, it's sad because as Howard says, it was had a huge potential to become a really major international city, and I think it's missed its chance.
Did you have any conversations with people there about that? Did they seem happy with the progress at the time?
No, frustrated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, very frustrated. So that's why I was asking Howard, you know, did it get better? Did a lot happen since I've been gone?
Wow.
And it sounds like it hasn't. Yeah.
It's gotten worse. And I think a lot of Christchurchians realize that something has slipped away from them. Something essential has kind of slipped away in the extent to which that opportunity wasn't seized. And it's a shame.
No one would ever point to a tragedy in any sort of positive light. And so I don't say this to say, well, it's a good thing the tragedy happened. But you did have kind of a canvas to work with that you would never have on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis in urban redesign.
And that happens a lot.
Yeah.
And it happens because of a hurricane or a typhoon. It happens because of an earthquake or a fire or other kinds of natural disasters, which give us the chance to say to ourselves, now that this terrible thing has happened, what can we do to make a better place? And we need to really keep our eyes on the ball when those opportunities arise so that we don't blow it and we don't do something which later we'll regret, because it doesn't prepare us best for our future and doesn't give us the best kind of urban experience that it could do.
Back to your phone calls, and Dave in Rochester has been waiting to jump in with a comment about infrastructure as it relates to the bicycle. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I found in the last couple weeks, I found that I became sort of an accidental bike person. My car went on the blink, so I've been getting around town on my bike. And I got to say two things. One, you know, using the bike lanes that they've added all over the city, some of them are awesome. Some of them are a little weird because they sort of disappear. But I love that they're everywhere. But the thing that I really wanted to say was I picked up the other day, I was riding over to Jiva, and I picked up that new bike path that I picked it up at Main Street that runs along where they did the fill-in on the inner loop on North Union. And they have this totally amazing, beautiful bike path. I mean, it's just It's set up. It's even green. It's got all the signage. It's set up just for bikes. The pedestrians have their own sidewalk next to it. And I just wanted to say it was something that clearly thought went into it. It was a great thing to add. I'd love to see, as the city continues to, you know, develop and do new stuff, to keep doing that kind of thing, because I literally kept, I was riding down the thing and I kept going, oh man, this is so cool. And it took me all the way around to the Strong Museum, and I thought that's just, it was great thinking, great planning, and I would just encourage the city to keep doing that kind of thing.
All right, Dave, thank you for that. I'm going to turn to Jackie Marchand, who's the president of Woman Tours, Inc., and if you're just joining us, her company provides bicycle tours 4 days, up to 7, 8 days, 9 days, something like that, around the world and here in the United States. And Jackie follows through in her daily life. She bikes all around Rochester all year long. So if you're grading, based on Dave's phone call, he's talking infrastructure and what's changing. I want to know what you think the best bicycle infrastructure city in the world that you've been to is, and then, giving that an A grade, what is Rochester's grade?
Ooh, I guess the best one that I've been to is Amsterdam. They're pretty well known for their cycling. Everybody bikes everywhere there. But they do have trams and subways and trains that help them, and canals and boats. And where do we go? Oof, you know, we are on a totally different scale, unfortunately. We're like one to their 2,000.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, we have a long way to go. But to Dave's point,
yeah,
you know, that was the inner loop that they took out, that we took out, and we put that wonderful bike lane in, wonderful sidewalk. Well, we're talking about doing it to another section of the inner loop, so let's hope for the best.
Okay. And Howard, a whole separate conversation sometime soon should be, we've had listeners say, hey, wait a second, what is going on with that inner loop space? So we'll have that conversation
soon.
Yeah,
because we're, as Jackie says, we're on the verge of finally getting rid of the northern portion. And obviously, Dave has seen for himself how wonderful that could be. So, but actually, Dave has actually given me an idea, Evan. I think what we need to do is we just need to take away one or two spark plugs from everybody. And when their cars go on the fritz, don't you think? We just have take away a spark plug day, and then everybody has to walk or bike or...
Every day this week, we're going to have interesting ideas that will never happen. Yesterday, Jim Maxwell, who's running for Congress, said he wants to meet the president, ask for his cell phone, and never give it back. Well, I don't know that that will happen, Dr. Maxwell. And Howard, I don't know about the spark plug thing. But maybe every day we'll have these pie-in-the-sky ideas. Hey, before the hour's over, give us a little homework. Who's Peter Calthorpe?
Peter Calthorpe is a planner, an architect, and an urban designer. He's an American. He lives in California. He's been practicing for many years. He has been working in China for decades. And in February of 2016, miraculously, the Chinese government decided to pass a master plan for urbanism authored by Peter Calthorpe. Peter Calthorpe is one of the founders of the Congress for New Urbanism. He believes that cities should be mixed and dense and all the things that we talk about all the time, that mobility is important and so on. And he has created this wonderful plan for Chinese cities, which has seven principal points, preserving the natural environment, mixing up uses and incomes and people and walking, biking, connecting things together and so on. And it remains to be seen whether or not the Chinese government actually executes the policy which they have adopted themselves starting in 2016. But if they do, it would be groundbreaking in terms of showing us what an urbanism of the future could look like. And fingers crossed that this is actually what happens.
Peter Calthorpe is the name to Google. Interesting stuff. And Linda emails to ask both of our guests this question. About a minute apiece here, I'll give to you guys. Linda wants to know, you guys talked about the damage that our highway systems can do to urban centers. What damage specifically, for those who doubt? That's from Linda. Howard, what's the damage we do when we do that?
We separate ourselves and the uses that we need from one another, as Jackie said earlier. We wound the city by creating places where there's nothing except cars. We create enormous amounts of pollution, which kills millions of people a year across the globe. We injure our health. There's a myriad of reasons why we should think seriously about the consequences of promoting that kind of movement in our cities.
Okay, Jackie?
Well, I think Howard pretty much covered it, but I will tell a little story. We do a cross-country tour on our bicycles that goes from California to Florida, and we end up having, we bike on small roads, but we get into these tiny villages and bigger cities, and we have to go to the outskirts to find a hotel to stay in every night. And every year on the evaluations I get, I thought I would stay in more historic hotels downtown. Well, they're not there anymore. They're gone because of our road system.
Online, where can people find where your tours might be going, by the way?
Womantours.com.
Womantours.com. Domestically and internationally, dozens of tours every year if you want to check it out. I will say, having been out with the WXXI Travel Club, I remember when we were in San Sebastian, my favorite stop on our tour this year, back in March, a city of about 250,000 people in the northeast part of Spain, so just a little bit bigger than Rochester, not much. The old section of town, and this is true in a lot of European cities, the old quarter, no cars at all. So you have all these wonderful pedestrian streets and a lane with 30 restaurants, pincho stops. It's wonderful. We walked all the way back to our hotel along the beach, and even in the sections of town where there are cars, they share the road. There are always people walking. There was a tunnel for cars going through this underpass and a tunnel for pedestrians built right next to it. No cars. No. So it was equal respect for all the different modes of transportation, and we walked from one end of the city to the other in just the afternoon, and I thought, oh, what a wonderful place to be, right on the beach with the WXXI Travel Club. So that's a future we can have. We can definitely have it, and Jackie and Howard have helped us envision what that looks like. Jackie is the president of Woman Tours, Inc., online at womantours.com. Jackie, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Howard Decker, board member of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Again, we will post his recent writings about travels to India and beyond. Come back soon. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Evan. I'd like that.
Unless we've exhausted all of the subjects here.
I don't think so.
I doubt it.
More Connections coming up.